This is URN Sport.
Federer at his very best. We saw in Shanghai those reflexes that are incredible, like a mongoose on amphetamine.
Murray wins it all. He's champion of the Barclays ATP World Tour Finals.
Has done it. Joe Konta. It is confirmed. Joe Konta with the biggest title of her career at the Miami Open and now also at a new career high.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. That ball was on the line. Shock flew up.
This is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to the first ever Strawberries and Cream Tennis Podcast, a new podcast from URN Sport covering everything to do with tennis and what's been going on. On this first episode, I'm joined by Rahul, Alex and Ollie. I'm your host, Matt Webb, and we're going to be reviewing the Australian Open, previewing the year of tennis and talking about whether male players should be played more than women players, as Novak Djokovic might think. So first of all, we're going to be starting off with Roger Federer, who won his 20th Grand Slam, beating Marin Cilic in 5 sets to win the Australian Open. He's the oldest man, bar Ken Rosal, in the Open era to win a Grand Slam. And quite simply, Ollie, do you think Federer can go on and win more Grand Slams in the coming couple of years?
I definitely think so. I think you've only got to look at the result of the weekend, where he was in imperious form. I don't think his win was ever in doubt. I think if you'd asked any person at the start of the tournament who they thought was going to win, every person in their right mind would have said Federer. The form that he's shown over the last couple of years has sort of defied all expectations of him, I think. I think there was a time a few years ago where people thought that was going to be the end of Federer, but he's come back stronger than ever, perhaps, and is by far and away probably the best player in the world at the minute, especially considering Nadal's injury problems. So yeah, I definitely can't see any reason why he can't carry on and add to his list of major tallies. I think if he did think that his time was up, he would retire. I think at the minute he obviously feels like he can continue winning majors. He obviously feels like he's in peak physical shape still. He doesn't seem to be showing any of the injury concerns that the likes of Djokovic, Murray and Nadal have been showing, and there doesn't really seem like there's anyone who can challenge him at the minute.
Yeah, I think it's only really us who thought Federer might be done in 2016. I mean, obviously he didn't play in 2 majors, so a lot of people might have thought that he was past his peak and injuries are finally catching up with him. But I think that's more Federer knowing more about himself than everyone else does. He knew that he needs a rest. He knows that he's 36 years old. He might not be able to compete with the kind of physicality of some of the other players. So I think Federer will definitely still be up there competing at Grand Slams, but I think he might not be able to do as many games as he previously was doing.
I think his uprising in the last few years has definitely been down to his management of which slams he's been performing at and which competitions he's been performing at. He's 36 years old now, and although his physicality may be decreasing, his management of which competition he participates in is definitely helping him reach the heights that he wants to achieve.
Yeah, obviously there were some moments to savour for Marin Cilic, who actually had a really good tournament. Obviously got to the final, played some brilliant tennis, took 2 sets off Federer, and really took advantage of Federer's serve faltering in the second set. And that's not something we've seen before. Alex, is it unusual to see Federer's serve faltering like he did at the end of the second set?
What do you mean? Roger Federer is the best player who's ever played, and he's obviously always had a good serve. It's not really one that's kind of the most powerful in the world, but the kind of his precision just kind of causes players absolutely carnage. So it was quite surprising to see Federer struggle on that front, but it's even more impressive to see Cilic kind of take advantage of that. I mean, not all players would be able to do that, because even Federer's not so great serve is still better than a lot of players' best serve. So yeah, as you said, Cilic had a much better tournament than much better final than he did last time against Federer at Wimbledon, and I think it's a real testament to Cilic.
Yeah, I mean, how long do we think he can go on for, guys? Rahul, do you think you could see Federer going on to his 40, perhaps? Or do you think that'd be a bridge too far?
As you mentioned before, if he keeps managing his competitions, then that would definitely aid him to keep playing for the next few years. But also, just going back to Cilic, I do think some credit has to be given to Cilic, because he did win the US Open in 2014. He has been in the Wimbledon finals, and he's been participating really well in the Australian Open. So it shouldn't really be that big of a surprise that Cilic is doing really well in these competitions and is taking sets off these big players such as Federer.
I don't really think it's a question of age, whether he goes on till he's 40, even 50. It's more a matter of what shape is his body's in physically, because at the minute it appears to be in better shape than any of his counterparts, even the ones, because I mean, if you think about it, I think Nadal, Murray, Djokovic are all younger than him, but all of their bodies are seemingly faltering more than his at the minute. So it's about what physical shape he keeps himself in. I think Rahul touched on a very good point about his management of what events he's competing, when to take a break is second to none, and I think that's been a crucial factor in his success, and I'm sure he will go on for at least a couple more years, because yeah, he definitely doesn't seem like there's any sign of him faltering at the minute.
Yeah, and I think in my opinion, the reason that he doesn't struggle with these injuries is because he's adapted his game. I mean, we said, I think on the Tuesday Sports Show a few weeks ago, that Nadal still plays at the same pace that he's always done, and that's led to him having multiple injuries throughout his career. Well, Federer, as we said earlier on, he knows how to manage himself well, and that's meant that he's always been able to adapt his style to his body, and that's why he doesn't suffer from the same extent of his injuries as the other players.
Yeah, going back to Federer's serve as well, which we were talking about as well, I think it's possibly one of the most underrated that we've ever seen in tennis, because he's not considered in the same bracket as some of these big servers, the 6'7", 6'8" players, these likes of Kevin Anderson, Milos Raonic, even Marin Cilic, but he's consistently been one of the best servers out there. As you touched upon, it's incredibly hard normally for people to try and break his serve, and I think because he's got such a fluid serve, he doesn't seem to exert that much energy into it almost. That's almost prevented him from sustaining so many injuries over the years that perhaps other players might have done. And then just to touch on Cilic as well, I think credit really does have to go to him, because typically one of his main problems has been breaking the opposition serves. He's always had a reliable serve himself, and the reason he perhaps hasn't had more success in majors is because he hasn't managed to break the serves of some of these top players. So yeah, credit definitely has to go to him.
Yeah, so I think if we stick with the men's tournament for a minute, the other main talking point from that was the rise of Carl Edmund from a British point of view, who had a fantastic tournament, reaching the semi-finals of a Grand Slam for the first time. He spent his off-season in the Bahamas working on his serve and return, and that has definitely paid dividends, because he chalked up some really big wins, beating Kevin Anderson in the first round and Grigor Dimitrov in the quarterfinals. So these fantastic wins for Edmund. Just how far do you think he can go, Rahul, in the top of men's tennis?
I think we've seen a real big turning point for Edmund, especially since his training camps where he was playing with Andy Murray specifically. I think he's really gained that wealth of experience and that knowledge which Murray has obviously clearly provided with him. And that sense of confidence can only further boost his career in the future years. So I think this could really be a start for something, even for in the Davis Cup. Edmund could really help Murray in terms of winning the games against other countries. So this could be the start of something really special for him.
Yeah, I think we thought in general that Carl Edmund might not reach the kind of heights of Andy Murray in summer. Maybe we were going to have like a kind of a breath of talent after Murray retired, but it's really good to see Carl Edmund stepping up to plate, even if it might be a little bit later than some of his counterparts. But all his best form has come in recent years, really. I mean, the semi-final, especially this year, kind of typifying how much he's come on as a player. And I definitely think that, as we said early on, if Andy Murray is on his way out, I think it's a very good time for Carl Edmund to really be upping his performances.
Yeah, I touched upon this on the Tuesday Sports Show yesterday, but I think Alex has hit the nail on the head, as in he's at the peak age, I think, in tennis at the minute. Considering sort of how we touched upon how old Federer is and how the likes of Djokovic and Nadal, Murray may be in a period of decline now. So I think Carl Edmund, considering he's only 22, 23... is at the peak age for him to push things to the next level. I think if you look at the players around him who are a similar ranking and a similar age, you've got the likes of Alexander Zverev, the German. You've got Lucas Pouy and Nick Kyrgios. Nick Kyrgios has obviously been plagued with off-field problems, and although he looks like he's getting his career back on track somewhat, I think Carl Edmund has sort of leapfrogged him in terms of the pecking order at the minute. So if you look at the other two as maybe slightly better than Carl Edmund at the minute, you could still see Carl Edmund as potentially being a top three player in the coming years, especially once Federer and the others retire.
Yeah, so Edmund obviously making really important strides in his tennis, and we all hope that he will maybe not become the next Andy Murray, but he can certainly push on and achieve greater things for British tennis in the future. Alex, how do you think he might fare at Wimbledon this year?
I definitely think Carl Edmund's got a chance. I mean, it's not really his domain. I mean, obviously all the English fans will want him to succeed at Wimbledon, but it's pretty in all the grandstands where he's performed worse. I mean, in 2017 he got his best performance there, and that's only the second round. And if you compare that to this year getting the same final of Australian Open, it doesn't seem to suit him as much, Wimbledon. But obviously we're English, we're always going to hope he does well there, and I'm sure that he's going to do better than he has done in the past, but I'm still not so sure if he's really going to challenge as much as he has done in Australia.
Yeah, it's surprising because I think he's only ever won one game at Wimbledon in six attempts or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's been to the tournament six times, I believe, and only won one match, which is certainly, I think you'd have to say, surprising for a player of his relative calibre. So I think it's safe to say that Garros is perhaps a less favoured service of Edmund.
The thing is, though, I think if you look at his game, he's got all the necessary characteristics to succeed on grass. He's got that big serve, which we talked about. He's got a phenomenally good forehand, and they're seemingly two of the biggest traits for succeeding on the grass surface. So it's surprising that he hasn't won more games at Wimbledon. I think Carl Edmund's come out and said himself that the court that he favours is clay, which again baffles me, especially as such a big guy. Clay has historically been a surface where you need good movement, you need to be agile, like Rafael Nadal, of course. So that's a surprising one. But then again, yeah, clay, he has seemingly had his most success on clay. His victories in the Davis Cup over top-ranked opposition did come on clay. So fingers crossed he can succeed on all courts.
Yeah, I think one thing he might actually benefit from this year, which he hasn't had in the past, is his higher ranking. I mean, he's now ranked 26th in the world, so he'll quite likely have a higher seed at Wimbledon this year. So obviously he won't be facing some of the bigger players so early on like he has done in the past. So even though it might not be his favoured course at the moment, he's definitely going to have more of a chance playing against probably some lower ranked players.
And we also got to consider that even in the semi-final, although it was a magnificent achievement getting there, he was injured and he did have to call a trainer. So there is potential for him to even potentially win these Grand Slams in the future, especially in the next Australian Open or in the other clay court tournaments.
Yeah, so obviously a bright future hopefully for Carl Edmund, and we hope we'll be talking about him in much more detail in future on Strawberries and Cream. I think we stick with the British tennis theme and we look at Jo Konta, who's at the other end of the spectrum really. She lost 6-4, 7-5 to the world 125th Bernarda Parra in the second round, and has now lost 9 of her last 14 matches since reaching the semi-finals of Wimbledon last year. So it's obviously been quite a big dip in form for Jo Konta. Ollie, should we be concerned about her at all?
I think we should definitely be concerned. I mean, losing 9 out of 14 games in a row, losing 9 of her last 14 games is definitely cause for concern. I think if any player had that record, even the top players, the likes of Caroline Wozniacki, Simona Halep, as I'm sure we'll touch on in a minute, if any of the top tennis players lose that many games in that period of time, then there's cause for concern. But I think Konta's proved in the last couple of years that she is a quality tennis player. I mean, it was disappointing considering the Australian Open is probably her favourite tournament, but we've seen that she's got the necessary credentials to be a top player. She's beaten the top players before, and I'm sure she'll come back stronger.
She's also had a lot of injuries, especially with her. She had a major foot injury, and that required her having to withdraw from the Brisbane International Open. So I think these losses do need to be taken account of, especially in light of her injuries in the past year, which has meant she hasn't able to get that consistency which she previously had.
Yeah, so Konta obviously looking to rediscover her form. Could this be partly put down to the fact that the gap between the top players and the challenging players is much closer in the women's game, Alex, do you think?
Oh yeah, I mean, it definitely does play a part. But I wouldn't say that Joanna Konta personally is that far away. I mean, she's not had success in the past. I mean, she's been a semi-finalist at two major tournaments. So I don't think that necessarily is a point. I mean, we say in the men's game as well that a lot of that it's been dominated by the kind of top four for a long time, so it's only recently that that's being broken up. So yes, I mean, Jo Konta might not be quite good as some of the top players, but she has proven that she does have the ability to defeat them, and I think it's more of a confidence issue at the moment. I mean, losing in the semi-final of Wimbledon would have been gutting for her, and I think this might have just been a catalyst in kind of just a kind of downturn in confidence and form. I mean, I'm not sure what she can do to rectify that. Maybe she's got a new coach, a sports psychologist. I mean, there's a lot of things she can do, but I wouldn't say it's because she's that far away from the top players.
Yeah, I think with the exception of Serena Williams, who's obviously a class above the rest, the gap between the top women players in the tennis game really isn't as much as some might expect. I mean, I think you only need to look at Caroline Wozniacki, who's just moved to world number one, having won her first major at the weekend. The fact that she's made it to number one, having never won a major before, I think really goes to show sort of the closeness between these women's tennis players. And you also look at Joanna Konta, who was seeded, I think, ninth and possibly one of the favourites for the tournament. He got knocked out by the world number 153 or something.
Well, it's 123.
Almost got it. Yeah. But no one seemingly heard of this, woman. But she came, and she quite rightly, I think, deserved the victory over Joanna Konta. So yeah, I think that just goes to show that, especially without Serena Williams, the women's game is definitely a lot more competitive than the men's game.
And on that note, I think we need to now look at the final of the Australian Open, which saw the two current best female players in the world matched up in Caroline Wozniacki and Simona Halep. And it was a really good match. I watched it, and it was definitely a close contest. Could have gone either way. Both players played phenomenally well. But Caroline Wozniacki won in three sets to win her first major final, I think something like 8 years after she was first world number one, and first in a Grand Slam final. So obviously a big moment for her. And do you think Caroline Wozniacki can go on to dominate women's tennis, Rahul?
I think winning this, although she was number one, I think during 2010, and then she was number one over, I think, 1 or 2 years. I think definitely this has given her the confidence, I think, that will pedestal her in future competitions. I think the burden of being number one yet not having won a Grand Slam definitely weighed her down over the last few years, and she repeated that during the press conference. And especially after she won the competition, she did say that the main achievement was proving the press wrong. So I think this definitely could be something which she can jump on and definitely do well in future competitions, having got rid of that burden as such.
Yeah, I think it's really good to see her kind of finally kind of break that duck, because she did have a bit of a downturn in form for a little while after being number one in the world. And I think, as Rahul said, like, the kind of burden of being number one and not having won a major might have contributed to that. So it's nice to see kind of Wozniacki kind of rediscovering her kind of class, because as the old saying goes, I mean, form is temporary, class is permanent. And I think it's always in about time that she was going to win Grand Slam. It was always inevitable. And I think defeating one of the best players in the world after kind of Wozniacki and Serena Williams and Halep is very impressive.
Yeah, undoubtedly a great contest there. Would it be really good if we could have Simona Halep and Caroline Wozniacki establish a really tight, exciting rivalry in women's tennis? Because I think men's tennis was really set alight in the mid and late 2000s with the rivalry between Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer, who are both at the top of their games, playing phenomenal tennis, producing some absolute classics like the 2008 Wimbledon final. Do you think that could really spark a greater interest in the women's game, although it definitely does have a massive following?
Potentially, I think. Whichever way you look at it, I think a lot's going to depend on what happens to Serena Williams, how quickly she comes back for injury, indeed how long she carries on before she retires. But if that is sometime in the near future, which you'd probably say it would, especially if she... I don't know if she's broken... Has she broken the record for most slams ever?
I think it's in the open era. I think Margaret Court has won the most Grand Slams overall. But since the tournaments became open to both professionals and amateurs in 1972, I think it was. I believe she's won the most. And I think she's done it in a very convincing way as well.
Exactly. I don't think anyone would doubt that she's probably the best female tennis player of all time, unless you want to consider this other woman, Margaret Court or whatever.
Margaret Court. She was an Australian player. Who has the name? Who has the arena named after her at Australia? Although she has courted some controversy recently over some homophobic views, but I think that's a bigger issue for another time, perhaps.
Oh, the less said about her, the better, then, I suppose. So, obviously, we've got to hold Serena Williams in high regard, especially considering what she's done for the women's game. If indeed she does retire fairly soon, then I think you're right. I think we could be looking at potentially a rivalry between Halep and Wozniacki. I know Wozniacki is a phenomenal character outside of the tennis court as well. I've seen various interviews with her where she's sort of mimicked reporters and gone undercover and in a disguise and whatnot. So she seems like a great character, aside from being a phenomenal tennis player. So it would be great for the women's game if they could establish a long-standing rivalry that will finally get people not talking about Serena Williams and focusing on some of the other great tennis players in the women's game.
Yeah, I definitely mean anyone likes in any sport just to see one person or one team dominating. So it's definitely going to be good for the game to see some competition. And I think in an ideal world, it won't just be those two. Now, other players can rise to the ranks to make it as challenging as possible, because everyone likes unpredictability and no one wants to know who the winner is going to be. So I think the more players rising to the top, the better.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see how that develops women's tennis over the coming couple of years. And I think that really concludes our roundup of the Australian Open. A phenomenal tournament again, with many talking points. And now we're going to move on to previewing the year ahead in tennis. So I think if we just return to the men's game for a second. So obviously, Federer in 2017 had a great year, winning the Australian Open and Wimbledon and several other Masters tournaments. He's won the Australian Open again for this year. Do we think he can dominate this year? Alex, do you think he's got the potential to really stand out and be world number one again?
I think he certainly does, because we, as we touched on earlier in the show, the other players have really, the top players have actually struggled for form, and injuries, as they're kind of shown in the Australian Open. I mean, none of the top four were in the kind of, or the kind of the big four, I should say, were in the semi-finals. So I think Federer's really got a chance to dominate this year, and as long as he doesn't suffer from injuries himself, there's no reason why he can't reclaim number one spot.
I don't think there's any reason, yeah, like Alex said, why he can't reclaim his number one spot. That being said, I'm not really sure how much he'll crave it, considering he's been the world number one various times throughout his career. I think at one point he was world number one consecutively for almost 3 years or something, which is the longest span of time anyone's ever been at the top. And like Rahul was touching on earlier, his management of when he plays and when he trains is so good that I don't think he'd really go about exerting himself at all of these tournaments and playing as much as possible, which is almost what it takes to become world number one. He could almost reclaim it by just continuously winning all these majors, couldn't he? So I think there is the chance that he could retain top spot, but I don't think that's going to be his primary aim. I think his aim is going to be trying to add to his already large amount of silverware.
It'll be interesting to see whether, because there is potential for him to reclaim the number one spot if he participates in the Dubai Open next week, especially given the circumstances where he often doesn't perform in ATP World events and rather focuses on Grand Slams. If he does choose to participate in this event, then that he could potentially reclaim first spot, especially if things go his way in regards to Nadal. So that's something that's definitely to look forward to, and to see whether he can and does decide to participate in it.
Yeah, I mean, he's talked about the need to manage his schedule. We've touched upon the fact that he's 36 now, obviously getting on a bit, and whilst he still appears to be moving well and in great physical shape, he missed the French Open last year in order to manage his schedule. Can we see him doing that again this year, Ollie?
I think so. I think, like I touched upon just now, if he feels that he's not in peak physical condition and that it might affect his chances of playing future tournaments, then I don't think he'll risk it. I think if Nadal's back for that tournament as well, that might be another factor swaying his decision, because if Nadal's fit and firing on all cylinders again, then you'd back him to win the French Open for I don't know how many times now.
I think he's won it 10 times, which is phenomenal.
It's an ungodly amount of times, and I think Federer knows, he's had so many finals with him now, he knows that Nadal is the superior player on clay. He has won his single French Open to complete all four of the Grand Slams, so he doesn't need it to add to his collection. So I think, yeah, there is the chance that we could see Federer pull out of Roland Garros to focus on the two remaining tournaments of the year. I think we obviously know that Wimbledon is by far and away his favourite tournament, so he's definitely going to want to be fit for that. So yeah, we could potentially see him take a break.
I think it depends how the season goes. I don't think he'd have already made up his mind about the French Open, because as you said, he's only won it once, and I mean, we were saying earlier that he might not be that bothered about reclaiming his number one spot. We might be bothered at the fact that he's only got one French Open, and I know it's not his best court, and he's always had Nadal, who's dominated it by a landslide. So I think Federer definitely still will want to win this tournament, as it's one that he's struggled in so much in the past. And if he is picking and choosing, it really depends what he's trying to prioritise this year, winning Wimbledon again or winning something that he's not been so successful in.
Yeah, I think we move on from Federer to the other top male tennis players. We've talked about the big four in the last few years of Murray, Djokovic, Nadal and Federer dominating. But actually, Federer is the only really fit and healthy one of them at the moment. Do you think this year could see the end of the road for some of them? Perhaps Djokovic lacking motivation coming back from injury and Murray really struggling with his hip and requiring surgery on that. Rahul, what do you think about that?
I don't think this is the end of the top four. I think they will still continue over the next year, and we saw that with Nadal previously. Over the last few years, people thought this was going to be the end of Nadal, and his recurring knee injuries would inevitably lead to his downfall, but he has come back, he has been resurgent, and as we can see in the last year, he claimed two of the four Grand Slams. So I still think with a run of form, with good consistency, these top four players will still be fighting out for the competitions.
Yeah, I think it depends how they adapt their games, really. I mean, at the moment, they're all struggling with injuries, and they're all getting on in age as well. I mean, Djokovic and Murray are both 30 years old, which is nothing compared to Federer, but I think it all depends on how they manage their games. It might be that they should just take a few months out of the game, work on their fitness, and not just kind of rush themselves back in just to play in as many tournaments as they can. Because at the rate it's going, their form is suffering from these injuries, and it's not going to be good for their legacy as much as their current performances.
Yeah, I think it's a tough one to say. Like Alex said, I mean, all three of those top players, aside from, oh, obviously you've got Federer, but the other three top players in Murray, Nadal and Djokovic, they've all got reason to still carry on playing. I mean, Nadal will be chasing Federer's record because I think it's still just about in touching distance, and Nadal's sitting on 14, 15 majors, I think, himself. So
yeah, so it's obviously only a few away, and if he has a couple of good years with Federer retiring, it's definitely possible to achieve it.
Exactly, and I think Djokovic as well. I think he's in double figures now, and he's obviously a few years younger than the others, so if he can get the better of Andy Murray, if he's still continuing to play, and get the better of some of these younger players coming through, the likes of Kyle Edmund, then he could be well up there in a few years' time. I think the player who I would probably see retiring first, who a lot of people don't really regard as in high regard as the big four that we've spoken about, is Stan Wawrinka, who has won three majors, I think, in his time. He's won all but Wimbledon, where he made the quarterfinals in 2014 and 2015. He's been a great tennis player for the past 6 or 7 years now at the top of his game. I think he's beaten all four of those top players a few times in his career. But I think it's getting to the stage now where he's getting on a bit. He's been plagued with injuries fairly recently. He suffered a fairly early exit at the Australian Open this year, so I think we could potentially see him retire fairly soon, but the other three, I think, will hopefully be continuing to fight on for at least a few more years.
Yeah, I think that concludes our preview for the men's tennis, really. It's definitely going to be an interesting year, and we look forward to the twists and turns that we'll cover on Strawberries and Cream through the coming months. If we now look towards the women's game, obviously the big void of the Australian Open was the lack of Serena Williams, who is aiming to come back after giving birth to her first child. Rahul, do you think it's possible for her to come back? It's obviously been quite a difficult time for her. It's not easy recovering after childbirth, but can she come back and recover her former form?
I mean, I think it's definitely possible. I mean, there was reports that she even was playing tennis. She continued playing tennis while she was initially pregnant. So she definitely has that mental strength, as we can see with the number of injuries and the number of battles she had with her sister Venus Williams back in years ago. So we can definitely see the mental strength in her capacity to keep performing, and as over the last 5 years she's been absolutely dominant in women's tennis, and I think this will definitely continue even after, despite giving birth to a child.
Yeah, I think Rahul touched upon it. I'm pretty sure Serena Williams won the Australian Open while supposedly pregnant last year, which is unbelievable and says a lot about how good she is as a tennis player. I think the fact that people are talking about her potentially challenging male players really says a lot about how much better she is than all of her female counterparts. So I think she'll probably take a bit of time off now, but I feel like she could almost return at any stage she wants, really. It's about whether or not she's still got the hunger to carry on, and as long as she does, I reckon she'd go straight back to the top of women's tennis.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that goes this year. As we saw last year, with the absence of Serena Williams, the women's game was much more open. There were the number one position changed hands 7 times in the female game, whilst only twice in the male game last year, which I think gives a bit of an indication as to the difference of form, perhaps, amongst the top players. So, do we see that happening again this year, or do we see perhaps Halep and Wozniacki dominating the rankings, or will Serena Williams return and become world number one? I think it's a difficult one to call, Alex. What would you suggest for that?
The thing is, it's not, as you said, it was 7 times number one change. I don't think it is just these two players who are going to dominate. I definitely think Alina Svitolina, how do you pronounce it?
Alina Svitolina, I think, and then I think Pliskova as well was another contender.
Yeah, I think both of those players have got a very good chance of challenging at the top, and Muguruza also has a lot of pedigree, and I think, unlike the men's game, I think we definitely could see more challenging. Definitely see the number one spot changing hands a lot this year, especially with the return of Serena Williams.
Yeah, I think that really concludes our preview of the year in tennis for women. Now, on Strawberries and Cream, every episode we're going to do a discussion on an issue in tennis that doesn't directly involve the actual competing and playing. So this week, before the Australian Open, it was reported that Novak Djokovic was angling for a male players' union to be formed in order to aim to give them greater wages and prize money ahead of female players, which has obviously been a controversial issue in tennis for many years. if you weren't aware, tennis is one of the few sports in which male and female tennis players are rewarded equally in their prize money, although the argument is that men's tennis has a larger audience and they play for longer matches in Grand Slams. So, would you think a formation of a male's union would be a positive thing for tennis, Ollie?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't really agree with Novak Djokovic personally. I think he obviously said the same thing a couple of years ago, and he feels quite strongly, but I think you hit the nail on the head, Matt, when you said that tennis, out of all the sports out there, has probably got the balance right at the minute. I think since 2007, both men and females have been, or males and females, sorry, have been paid the same in majors, which is the correct decision in my opinion, whilst in the WTA and ATP sort of masters events, the males get paid slightly more than the females, and I think that's mainly due to viewing figures, because the males do get far superior viewing figures, and I think that's fair enough. I think if you look at other sports, no one really contends the notion that males get paid more than females in football, because there's far more viewing figures in that. And as a, if you think sort of other sports, netball, I mean, no one's ever heard of a male netball, or no one really knows much about male netball teams, but they do exist. But I don't think anyone would ever suggest that they should get paid more than their female counterparts, because female netball has far wider coverage. But so I think at the minute, I think tennis has got the balance completely right. Both males and females getting paid the same in these big events, which are broadcast by all and watched by all. But in the smaller events, the males are getting slightly more money because there's more wider coverage.
I'm going to personally have to disagree with Ollie here. I mean, I do understand that there's been a big movement for females to get equal pay, and I definitely think there should be equal pay from between men and women when there's equal work. But the argument is that, as we've touched on earlier, is that the men do play more sets in the Grand Slam, and that is a bigger toll on the their physical nature. They've got to play for a longer time. It means they struggle to recover more. They've also means they've got to play as a struggle to recover more for other tournaments as well. And I think that definitely does kind of mean that they deserve to earn more money. I mean, you could say that women get positive discrimination in the majors from the fact that, just because of the desire for quality of outcome, means that they should have the same amount of pay, even though they don't do the same amount of work.
I understand your point there, and I think it's a very valid one. But at the same time, I think a lot of women tennis players have come out and said that they have nothing against potentially playing longer matches. I think if you look at the women's game in general as well, sometimes it can be that women's matches go on longer than men's, especially if Roger Federer is playing at the best of his game and polishes off his opponent inside an hour or so. Some of these female finals can go on even longer than the male's game. I think it was the Wimbledon final 5 or 6 years ago where the female final actually went on longer than the male one. I also think if you're doing it like that, you've got to look at other sports and say, does that mean in cricket, if a player's batting longer than his counterpart, then he should get paid more? Does that mean because football matches are slightly longer than rugby matches, they should get paid more for that? I think it's a pretty hard one to judge, especially considering, like I said, that the women have nothing against potentially playing longer matches. So yeah, it is a tough one, but I can see where you're coming from.
Even adding upon Djokovic's claims, he also demanded for a greater distribution of prize money in terms of to everyone participating, and I think that is actually a positive thing to actually enforce and to try and progress in the future, especially because a lot of the lesser known tennis players who are unable to get through the qualifying rounds do struggle to keep competing internationally and keep coming to these world tours. So if they were to increase the distribution of money, this would definitely help. But then the Australian Open have stated that within the next 5 to 6 years the prize money would definitely double. So I think in some sense Djokovic is being a bit selfish in terms of demanding for increased pay.
Yeah, I think leading on from what Rahul said there, is it selfish for Djokovic to demand increased prize money when the man's won $110 million of prize money in his career, has made lucrative sponsorship deals with a tennis racket manufacturer Head, Uniqlo clothing, people like this? Is this a bit hypocritical for him, Alex?
Yeah, I definitely don't think the basis of him complaining to me, him demanding more money. I mean, as you just noted, he does get superior amounts of money from sponsors, but I think it's more, the only side of the argument I really agree with him on is when he says that their work level kind of deserves more pay in terms of actual prize money than the women's game. But yes, I do, in a rounding up, I do agree that definitely the way he's gone about this and the kind of hypocritical nature of some of his statements does kind of take away some of the validity of his argument.
Yeah, I think I've seen the comments that Djokovic has made, and I personally think that he's coming at it from a very selfish perspective. I don't really think it's a matter of him thinking about the less experienced younger players who haven't quite made the grade yet and trying to improve their situation. I think it's more about his own self-gain and how he thinks he should be earning more money when, like you touched upon, Matt, he's got career earnings of over 100 million, he's got various sponsorship deals. So in that sense, I think he's been quite selfish. I also think that the fact that some sportsmen don't get paid quite as much as others is just part and parcel of sport in general. I mean, it's unfortunate, but if, again, making comparisons with the likes of football, some of these lower league players are putting just as much effort in as some of these higher tier players who play in the Premier League and the Champions League and internationally. Yet there's a vast difference in the amount of money that they're earning. So although these tennis players are obviously putting in superior amounts of effort, I think
it's a difficult one for us to talk about as perhaps in terms of the gender view, because obviously we are four men, so it's perhaps more difficult for us to empathise with the female side of this. But I think that brings a nice end to our discussion on this issue. And that was the first episode of Strawberries and Cream, a new tennis podcast from Euren. Do tune into future episodes. I've been your host, Matt Webb, and I was very pleased to be joined by Ollie, Rahul and Alex for our first episode. And I'm sure there'll be many more to come over the coming weeks. Thank you again for listening.
This is URN Sport.